Hello everyone, I'm Troy Dodds and welcome to the On The Record podcast presented by The Western Weekender. On this podcast, I'm joined by special guests who all have such great stories to tell about Penrith and the role they've played in our city. They are Penrith stories told by Penrith people. Today, my special guest is Kyra Quinlivan. Kyra doesn't fit the usual mould of an On The Record guest. In fact, she's the youngest ever guest on the podcast. But in recent times, she's taken on an important role, becoming a domestic violence victims advocate in a city plagued by the issue. While Kyra does have her own story to tell, for legal reasons, we've opted to focus purely on her advocacy, and this podcast certainly makes no judgments or assertions in relation to any individual. Kyra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First question we always ask, where and when were you born and where'd you grow up?
I was born and raised in Penrith, born in Nepean Hospital, and I grew up here all my life.
All right, so you grew up early sort of 2000s or late 90s Penrith?
Yeah, 1991 girl.
Okay, what was your childhood like? What was Penrith like at that time?
I think I had quite an average upbringing, I think. My parents divorced when we were quite young, so we split our time between mum and dad's house. But, you know, it was generally going to school every day, coming back, playing with our friends and, you know, looking at the, you know, we didn't have phones and like watches and things back then. So you look up at the sky and think, oh, I think it's about dinner time now. And, you know, you make your way home and yeah, it was just pretty average.
And what schools did you go to?
I went to Cambridge Gardens Public School, school captain in Year 6, and then I went to Xavier College.
Now, you mentioned that your parents got divorced. How did you handle that, or how do you think that impacted your childhood?
I didn't really notice it, to be honest. Yeah. I think, you know, if my parents were fighting, you know, we didn't see it. So, you know, They appeared pretty amicable to us.
Now, like many young people, you got sort of itchy feet in your early 20s after high school, decided Penrith wasn't for you. What was in your head at that time? What was kind of life like for you, and why did you, I guess, want to get out, so to speak?
I think I kind of just had a sense of needing a little bit more. I think, you know, growing up here, you know, I'd never really even been to the city. Like, it was just very much like Penrith and working in Penrith. My friends were all in Penrith, so I had a bit of a weird obsession with Harry Potter as well. So from a very, very young age, I've just always loved the idea of England. So it was, I was a strong, independent woman. I, you know, wanted to shape my own journey in life. And yeah, just wanted a bit more of adventure, I think.
And yeah, as you mentioned, you decided to go to London, but you do go on your own. So yeah. What was your family's reaction to that initially? And you know, normally I guess that's something that someone says, oh, I'm going to go for 3 months or whatever. Yeah. But for you, this was going to be a permanent change.
Yeah, so I actually applied for the working holiday visa. So the intention was to go there for 2 years. My parents were really supportive. My family, my friends, my work colleagues and things, you know, they really helped like educate me and prepare me with using their experiences and things. So it wasn't a very big decision. It was like the only decision. Like I knew exactly what I wanted and, you know, setting up a life over there is something that I wanted to give a go.
And you certainly did set up a life there. So tell me about your early time in London.
I mean, you know, there was a lot of partying, you know, enjoyed my early 20s, met a lot of amazing people, a lot of life experience, you know, traveling Europe, did it all on my own as well. Like I loved every bit of it. And I think the journey sort of really taught you some life skills and, you know, some things not to do again. And a lot of things of wanting a little bit more still.
And 2017, you have a very big life-changing moment. You give birth to a daughter, obviously having met someone over there.
Yeah.
So take me through all of that.
She was born in July 2017. And, you know, just like her birth, you know, just changed me. I loved every part of being a mum and, you know, just like going from the person travelling solo and going out drinking, partying, things like that. I found myself sort of navigating a real new purpose in life and, you know, just, you know, changing my life for the better. Like I made a lot of like better decisions. I stopped drinking, like, you know, really started like focusing on health and being like a good example. And, you know, just I've never let her sort of be any hold back or parenting limitation. If I was going for a bushwalk, she's strapped to me and she's going with me.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's at this point in our chat that Kyra speaks about her relationship. We've opted not to include this portion of the interview, but pick up where Kyra speaks about some of the tougher times she faced with her daughter while trying to get home.
I think I took every bullet for her and never let her see that we were navigating this. When we were homeless and we were sort of couch surfing and going from place to place, we treated it like a holiday. Like, oh, we're just going to go down here. This is really exciting. Like, oh, this is your new room. Look at these amazing bed sheets we got for you. Like, and like even lining up in a food bank. And I was just like, this is a like really special shop because we don't even have to pay at this one. We just get to take what we like. You know, we just made it really fun. And obviously her age as well. Like, we could add that magical element to make it fun for her. So she probably doesn't realize how much I was actually suffering at that time, because, you know, I'd be on the phone to my mum crying 1 minute, and then as soon as I've got to go back and attend to her, you know, straighten up again, you know, yeah. Tears are, you know, well and truly over. And I think if she ever did see me with a tear, it would be like, oh, you know, something got in my eye again today.
The period in which you're, I guess, classified as homeless, what kind of period is that?
It would probably be a couple of months. I was taken in by a charity group originally, and then to a old family friends of my dad's. My dad actually grew up in India, and an old friend that he went to school with was living in London. So I had a place with him. And then once I had my superannuation, I was able to get some temporary accommodation. So it was kind of just bouncing around for a few weeks. But I mean, in the first couple of days with not having home, anything secured, I slept on my gym.
Yeah, okay.
So that was definitely an experience.
At this point in our chat, Kyra speaks more about her relationship and her efforts to get back to Australia. She eventually does return with her daughter and comes back to Penrith.
When I left Penrith, I kind of felt like there was nothing here for me. And then as soon as I've come back, it feels like, you know, I'd never want to leave anymore. It's like the community that we have here after traveling all over Europe and everything, there's nothing like Penrith.
Kyra and I then have a chat about why she's chosen to become an advocate for domestic violence victims and such a prominent person in the domestic violence conversation in Penrith.
Well, silence gets you nowhere. I think there's a lot of elements in why it's such a complex issue, because you're going through a healing process. And I didn't really start coming out with my advocacy until this year. It was quite hard in those first couple of years, but I think as things didn't really get better for me, I decided, you know, I've got to just get my voice out there. And I think it's all about like education, the culture, the, you know, community attitude and legislation, and just being a bit like, I guess, eye-opening and using my voice of when you know someone who's been through it, or someone that you didn't think would ever have gone through it, I think it like helps other people, I suppose, believe that this is an issue. And I think when it comes from someone that you know as well, it sort of helps them be like, oh, okay, like I have seen you go through this. It's not just you making up, you know, things. It's actually happened.
Obviously, Penrith, you've returned to a city where we do have a frighteningly high rate of domestic violence. Where do you think we're at in terms of government and police response to this? Because I think that if this was any other crime or issue where we were seeing the amount of not just incidents reported, but deaths and murders of women, if this was any other crime, there would be royal commissions everywhere, there would be dramatic change everywhere. And it feels like that we use a lot of words, we you know, we wear white ribbons, we do all of this stuff that we think is going to make a difference, but nothing sort of shifts the dial.
Yeah.
So where do you think we're at in government, police response, that whole sector?
I think because it is such a complex issue with a lot of areas that need to be tackled, and that's like what I mentioned about, like, you know, the education, the culture, community attitudes, like, there's like, I suppose, like from my experience, that legislative and policy reform is like key, but like in my experience, there's things that I've learned about certain behavioural things over the last couple of years that I'm like, I wish I knew that earlier. Mm. And that's where that educational side comes in. And then I suppose, and when we're talking about it, having these conversations, that's where I suppose that cultural and community attitude side comes in. Like I've had guys reach out to me and be like, you know, thank you so much for sharing what you're sharing, because I didn't realize that I was kind of doing these things, and it's been quite an eye-opener in having to address my own behavior. But on the other spectrum, I've had women saying, you know, thank you for being the voice, you know, I went through this too. Just recently I went down to Penrith Court and I was speaking to a solicitor, just having a meeting and things, and I walked into the safe room and every single woman in there I knew. It was a reunion. One of my friends, my close friends, who I didn't even know was going through a DV issue, was in there. A friend that I was like best friends with in high school, she was in there. A girl I went to the gym with, she was in there. And when you look at the magnitude of like, this is almost just the normal, you know, the norm in our society. I think that's where that men's behavioural side of things, that it needs that accountability. And obviously it needs men calling it out as well.
That's obviously a really big element. And if you know someone who might have been your best friend for 10 years and then you see something that just doesn't seem right, that it's easy, I guess, to say, well, that you should just speak up about that.
Yeah.
But that's been a really difficult thing, I guess, for people to adjust to. Just say, well, no, I need to be the one to be the person who speaks out. And, you know, someone else isn't going to do it on my behalf.
Well, it's not always safe for people to do so. And, you know, everyone's in their own journey of where they're up to. And, you know, some people, you know, have the physical and sexual side of their abuse as well. And it can be very, very damaging to their health, you know, physical and mental. So I think, I suppose, it's because it's such a complex issue, it's all about when people are quite ready to be able to be that voice, and it's, I suppose, the people who aren't going through it, we would like to be louder.
Now, what would you like to see happen though from a point of view of government and legislation? What's the number one issue that you see that is a problem that we're just not getting past?
I have seen in my experience that there is a lot of policy and legislation that is very inconsistent in its definition of domestic violence. It's like you can go to the Women's Health Centre and they say that all of these things constitutes as domestic violence. And then you go into that legal system and their law says, no. Like, you know, there's a very, very small criteria of what that is. So I think that legislative reform is quite key. And I think, you know, it's not a prevention, it's an accountability.
And what about in terms of police and court response initially? So do we need to be tougher on perpetrators in the earlier stages? And what we mean by that is in a first offence situation or in an AVO breach or something like that, that are almost treated as minor offences but are actually pretty obvious that they are the start of something that's going to escalate.
I would certainly like to stop seeing it as a slap on the wrist. I think that accountability is key, because like I use that analogy as well. Like you can walk into a bank and steal money, there's going to be consequence. But, you know, to perpetrate abuse, it's almost like, oh, but it's the first time you've done it, so we'll let you off and, you know, don't do it again. But then, you know, the next time a woman's murdered. So, you know, I think that now that it is like a national crisis, a global crisis even, I think we need to stop being so soft.
You go to all of those murder situations that we've seen, and we've seen them here in Penrith, but also across Sydney nationally. There's been high profile cases. There's much less profile cases, which is the sadness of it all, because everyone is a human being, but obviously different stories get different coverage at different times. But in all of those stories, almost, you could pretty much go, well, there were red flags, there were previous incidents, he was on the radar at some point. So that would suggest that clearly we're not doing enough in those early stages.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot of reports, there's a lot of statistics, and I think it now really does come down to our leaders, our politicians, to really push that change. So it is a very, very complex issue, and I think it is all about like when you're willing and able to participate or speak up. But it's obviously being such a complex issue. I think it's just having a safe space to be able to talk about these things and sort of be in that movement of conversation.
Do you think that most people in the community understand the extent of this issue?
Absolutely not. And I suppose one of the key pet hates for me is when we say that, you know, the women and children, are, you know, in our community are victims of violence. I'd really like to change the tone and say there are men in our community perpetrating violence.
In general terms, when it comes to children in these situations, I guess we may well have sheltered them from these conversations in the past and maybe said, well, we don't want you to know that your uncle was this, or your dad was this, or dad's best mate doesn't come around anymore because of this, or whatever. How important is it, still knowing that children are children, and you know, we don't want to confront them with too many situations like that, but how important is it to actually have them as part of conversations in that space if we're going to fix this at a generational point of view?
I would love to see something within the school educational system to talk about what is and isn't a healthy relationship. And I think, you know, we don't want it to be specifically targeted at their own family and things like that. But I think, you know, for a child to be able to be aware of what is happening and what constitutes as, you know, unhealthy conversations and acts and things like that, it gives them the tools to, and, you know, an opportunity to be able to understand from a young age that this is probably not appropriate.
From a media perspective, I guess you would say that we've gone from just not reporting these issues probably even 10 or 15 years ago, unless it was some super high profile case, to within the bounds of the law, reporting this pretty regularly now, you know, media getting involved in different campaigns. So there's been a change there, but a lot of media organisations still pretty hamstrung from a legal perspective as well. So is navigating that difficult for people as well in terms of, you know, you might want to speak out, but this is stopping you. And then, of course, court proceedings, which in the more traditional sense are very public. Not so much in a lot of these cases.
I think the laws that really that are implemented to sort of protect the privacy of people really come at a burden of addressing the issue. We are quite silenced and limited in our ability to speak to media, and, you know, media, like, you don't see any you don't see a lot of like family law cases and stuff ever mentioned. And I guess it doesn't make good media when you're, you know, changing a voice and, you know, hiding their face, because it's also, I suppose, about entertainment value.
Well, this is difficult, like, even for us. So we have, you know, we have a court reporter who was at court at times, and we would literally, you know, and this is a really sad fact, but there is what they call DV day at Penrith Local Court, where pretty much every case is DV. So anyone who thinks that it's a couple of cases a week, like, there's pretty much a day dedicated to it. Well, we don't send a court reporter on that day because the reporting job is too difficult. It's a minefield to know what you can and can't cover. And obviously, there's identification issues attached there. We get all of that. But it is difficult. It's for both sides of the fence, because there would be some people there who victims there who would probably go, well, at least if this was out in the media, everyone would know.
You know,
and I don't have to be the one to tell people.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think it certainly is a limitation and a barrier to addressing the issue.
What does the next 5 years in Penrith look like for you now that you've made a home for yourself here?
I suppose, you know, readjusting to the heat after coming from London. But I guess for me, it's turning my pain into power, and using my voice to be able to help educate and sort of bring those stats down. I mean, just recently I won an art prize for, it was Campbelltown's DV Through Their Eyes competition, where I did a painting, and I won first place for that. And like, I didn't have to say a word. I literally just had to paint a painting of what I feel and see through art.
And what about family life, things like that? Just raising a daughter, I guess, in a great city like Penrith.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose like I love that I'm raising her in my hometown, and like, I'm giving her a little bit of sense of what life was like for mummy growing up.
Yeah.
And I love that we have our family close by and that those connections are all there, but she still holds a lot of that like value for her life in England as well. So I think for us, like, just for me, I suppose, like, just watching her grow and like watching her thrive is, you know, a key priority for the next 5 years. And
And how much has that family reconnection been important for you, you think, in rebuilding? Because you mentioned, you know, you stayed pretty strong for your daughter through this whole process. You know, you're doing everything like pretending you're on holiday when you're doing whatever. Just in a moment, I guess, where you can sit back and not have your daughter reflection on for yourself at the moment. Having that family support is obviously a huge help to be able to do that.
Huge. I think, you know, even just like Christmas and things like that, just knowing that, you know, it's not opening up a present by ourselves anymore. It's, you know, those big family gatherings where we all come together and, like, you know, like every other family, we've got the family dramas. We're not immune to it. You know, emotions are high. So, but I just suppose having that connection, and that support, you know, we all support each other. You know, it's that saying about it takes a community, you know.
Yeah. What would you say to someone who is going through a DV situation at the moment, no matter what it is, you know, if it's coercive control, if it's physical, sexual, what would you say to someone who's going through that at the moment as far as the first step is concerned? Because that first step is obviously often the most difficult.
Yeah, I suppose it's just making contact with the services that are there to support you. They are the ones, you know, educated and equipped with the tools that you need. And I think, you know, just don't be afraid to report things. You know, you might not have a voice publicly, but do it internally, speak to a friend and get that support that you need.
The last question that we always ask, and you know, you've got a lot of life left to live, but at the moment, how would you like to be remembered?
So this might sound a bit strange, but I don't want to be known as the DV advocate, because I feel like that sort of gives a profile of that's who all I am, and yeah. I'm not. So for me, I suppose I'd rather just be a symbol of hope, courage and bravery, you know, step outside your comfort zone, you know, challenge yourself, do more, stand up for yourself, stand up for your friends, and, you know, I guess, you know, never give up.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed our chat. If this podcast raised any concerns for you, the 24-hour domestic violence hotline can be reached on 1-800-737-732 or 1-800-RESPECT. Domestic violence takes on many forms. This is the final episode of On The Record for 2023. Thanks for listening in for our third series of podcasts. We plan to be back in 2024 with some more extraordinary Penrith stories. On The Record is produced by The Western Weekender. To hear future episodes, search Western Weekender wherever you listen to podcasts and make sure you hit subscribe. Check out westernweekender.com.au and we'll see you next time.